What's up, everybody? This is Todd Golden. This is edition four of the With a Bullet podcast. I'm here with my brother, Matt Golden. Matt, what's going on?
Hi, everybody. Did you watch the Grammys tonight, Todd?
Yeah, kind of. I was making fun of it mostly. Tanya Tucker presenting an award to Dave Chappelle was interesting, but apart from that,
right.
Grammys aren't really up my alley. Never really have been. My least favorite award show, because the Grammys have either been out of touch with me or I've been out of touch with them. And probably certainly the latter right now, because I'm old. So, did you watch them?
I cut the end of it. I actually heard that there was a performance of one of our songs tonight on the show.
Oh, boy. Because it's such an awesome countdown. So this week we are doing, as part of our top 40 recollection, we're going into the 90s. Because, Matt, that's our time. That's when we were young and full of life. And the world was in front of us at the time. But
right.
We're doing the Hot 100 from February 1st, 1992. Matt, where were you in 1992?
I was in eighth grade in Green, Ohio, which was a suburb of Akron and Canton.
And so how did the Hot 100 speak to you in February of 1992?
Well, I mean, there is one song kind of later on in our countdown that really did speak to me. But for the most part, I wasn't into most of this.
Either I would have been in my third year of college at this point, and certainly was probably heavy duty into classic rock at the time, probably to the point of obsession. And actually, when we started doing this podcast, I really didn't want to do many Hot 100s that came after the SoundScan era began. Which, if you don't know what SoundScan, it was Billboard decided to use a different method of tracking songs. In 1991, where they went from basically what was used to be sort of a survey to electronic monitoring of records so that they could actually track how many were sold. They used it through like a barcode and all that. And the charts changed pretty dramatically when SoundScan came into view, because you couldn't really fudge the charts anymore. I mean, there was a raw number of records and especially at that time, CDs sold. So that the chart started to really turn in a different direction starting after SoundScan. And a lot of the variety that you had on the charts in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and the beginning of the 90s really kind of started to disappear a little bit. I don't know if you feel that way. That's certainly the way I feel.
It definitely did, yeah.
I feel like, you know, the music world that we live in now is fragmented. People go seek out their own stuff. There are people who aren't that into music and still listen to the radio like people did back then. But real music fans, you know, have streaming. They can go to, like I do and you do, you could go to Spotify and listen to whatever you want. You can listen to you can basically create your own bubble. And that was a process. There were various reasons why that happened. Technology certainly was a big part of it. Streaming was a huge part of it. But I think SoundScan, if you traced it back, the fragmentation of what used to be the collective way we listen to music, which is how people got into these charts in the first place, versus today where you're, you know, probably I couldn't probably name more than two or three songs in the top 40 right now, and I'm being charitable. So
yeah, neither could I.
I can name Old Town Road.
Yeah, Old Town Road. Yeah.
I know that's a big favorite area. We should do a current chart, because that would be hilarious, because we'd be out of our...
I don't mind Old Town Road.
Oh, for Christ's sake. Anyway, I feel like SoundScan is where the fragmentation, if you wanted to trace a source to it, began, because people started to turn away from the top 40. And part of it was music trends. You know, I know for people from both of our ages, you know, this was when the rise of alternative music really began to become popular anyway. Grunge was starting. We'll see an example of that, I believe, on this chart, actually. But
right.
So some of it was music trends, but you know, your desire to listen to top 40 music kind of, for a lot of people anyway, kind of died out when SoundScan started to change the charts in the 90s. It's just my opinion, but but I think that's why this chart is interesting, because we're still like at the very beginning of SoundScan. So the musical tastes hadn't really changed that much in terms of the chart. There is a lot of R&B and a lot of
adult contemporary too.
Adult contemporary on the chart, which SoundScan tended to, especially in its early years, seem to favor on the charts. But there's still a little bit of that. It was like the dying age of the variety in the chart. Now, I'm not saying there's 10 rock songs, 10 R&B songs, 10 club songs, that kind of thing. But it is an interesting mix of music. Plus, music itself was changing at the time. A lot of these artists, what I noticed when I did mine, I don't know if you noticed this when you researched your songs, these were the last hits for a lot of these artists. A few of them were at the beginning of their time, but most of them were at the end of the line, at least as far as having big hits were concerned. So it's kind of a transitional period. It's interesting. Plus, a lot of these songs are funny and you can make fun of them. So
yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Anyway, I thought this one deserved a little bit of introduction. Where, as far as me in 1992, I might have heard these songs at a party or something like that, but I wasn't seeking this out either. So without further ado, let's get going. And number 40, and I know you were booming this one in your bedroom when you're in eighth grade, is Forever My Lady by Jodeci. What do you got on this?
Let's see. Well, Jodeci was one of the big slow jam groups, and slow jams were kind of like the dominant form of R&B in the 90s. And they were kind of marketed as kind of harder edged and like urban version of Boys to Men. But turns out that they were just guys who had background in gospel, grew up in North Carolina, and basically the whole image was a front. And
they were fronting?
I guess so, yeah. But this was written by Albie Schur, who was kind of a R&B star in the late 80s. And
that would be, by the way, Al exclamation mark. Or no, wait, it was Al B. Schur exclamation mark, right?
Correct, yeah.
Yes.
And this is one of those songs where, I mean, I remember Jodeci, but I didn't really remember the song until I heard it. I was like, oh, yeah, that song. And let's see, a couple of guys, Casey and JoJo, had a like one of the all-time great slow jam songs a few years after this, All My Life, but never really that big of a fan of Jodeci. And this made it to number one on the R&B charts, only made it to 25 on the pop charts, and it was kind of falling down, probably off the chart the next week after this.
Yeah, and I don't really have a whole lot of recollection of this one. I'll be honest. I'm sure I'd know it if I heard it, but Jodeci wasn't really in my wheelhouse at the time.
See, and with that, we'll go on to number 39, which is Masterpiece by Atlantic Starr.
This would normally be a skip for me, but I feel like this is kind of sets the tone for some of the other artists on the chart, because I would not have pegged Atlantic Starr, which is another I wouldn't say quiet storm, but very adult contemporary R&B group that had their biggest hits in the late 80s. So I don't really associate Atlantic Starr with the 90s. And this is pretty much straight down their wheelhouse, another kind of soft, I wouldn't say slow jam, but soft R&B song. It reached number three on the charts, which shows you how fucking out of tune I was at the time, because I don't even remember this song.
Right. Yeah, I thought this was much older. I thought this was like 86 or 87 here. Yeah.
So it was written by Kenny I Love Dreamin' Nolan.
Oh, nice. Nice.
It was Atlantic Starr. And the reason I kept this one is and didn't throw it in the lake, but it was Atlantic Starr's last top 40 hit. And we'll see, that's either last or second last hit is going to be a recurring theme as we go forward with some of these bands. So, you know, I don't even, I, I've Atlantic Star is not a band that you hear mentioned very often these days. So kind of a relic of their time. And this song is, you know, certainly that. So, you know, kind of wedding song material, I would say.
Yeah, exactly. Yep.
Yeah. So moving on from that, number 38, and I have zero recollection of this song either, Too Blind to See It by Kim Sims.
And this is my first skip. I hadn't heard it before either. It's kind of obscure, high-energy house track. This was actually its peak in its chart on the chart. And the one fact that I will throw out about it is that it went to number one in Zimbabwe.
Cool. Robert Mugabe was a big fan of Kim.
Yes, he was. But let's move on to number 37, which is In My Dreams by The Party.
All right, so this is a Dokken remake. Dokken, a 80s hair metal band that probably best known for doing the theme to Nightmare on Elm Street 3, Dream Warriors. This band, when you hear it, it sounds like, you know, this is a very kind of prototypical early 90s pop song. High energy, you know, pretty similar to pop that's out now, really. But, and I'm like listening to this without knowing anything about The Party, who I don't remember at all. And I'm like, man, this band sounds like something you'd hear on a, like one of the Disney shows that my kids used to watch when they were younger. And mm-hmm. Lo and behold, this band was formed by Disney from the remnants of the all new Mickey Mouse Club show, which was out in the very end of the 80s and very,
oh, wow,
90s. So, this trend of Disney stars, Ariana Grande, et cetera, is not new. Although this band didn't quite get as far as some of those some of the current artists did. I believe this was their only hit, or they may have had one other hit, but pretty forgettable song. But they do fit into the demographic of marginal groups that have a Homeric length Wikipedia entry. It could be up when these obscure groups list like every little thing they did when they happened to be in the spotlight. Like, it was like, yeah, we toured at the state fair in Iowa and it was a kick-ass gig and that kind of thing. So their Wikipedia entry is way longer than it needs to be. So, but The Party live on in that kind of infamy. So,
right.
Moving on, speaking of infamy, at least in my opinion, number 36 is There Will Never Be Another Tonight by Bryan Adams.
Let's see, and Bryan Adams was kind of like deep, deep into adult contemporary territory by this point.
He had sold his soul to the MOR devil.
Right, and this was from the same album as Everything I Do It For You. And this actually sounds like 80s Bryan Adams, though. I mean, kind of similar to Summer of 69, Cuts Like a Knife, Run to You. I mean, not his best song by any means, but it's decent for this era Bryan Adams. And he was kind of going through a controversy at the time in his home country over CanCon restrictions. Canada, they kind of mandate that a certain percentage of Canadian artists have to be played every hour. And you think that Bryan Adams would qualify under that, but he co-wrote every song out here with Mutt Lange, his producer. And Mutt Lange was from Zambia. So it didn't fall under CanCon for whatever reason. So I remember at the time Bryan Adams was on MTV, which didn't actually air in Canada, complaining about CanCon.
Wow.
It must not have affected him too much because the song actually did go up to number three in Canada. So it's just, basically just whining.
By this point, in Bryan Adams' career, I was at the stage where I was like, I wonder who cut his balls off. I actually don't mind his stuff up until about 87 or so, because it's basically 80s pop. You know, you could even call some of it power pop, not all of it, but some of it. And
this would probably qualify as that.
But by then, I had tuned him out. I was like, you have gone over the deep end and into the seventh circle of adult contemporary hell. So, and he would stay there pretty much. So,
right. And actually that provides a very good transition to our next song, which is number 35, When a Man Loves a Woman by Michael Bolton.
You know, this is, to me, I'm skipping this one. This is low hanging fruit. And I only say this, Michael Bolton's become a punchline over the years. And I don't know what's worse, Michael Bolton's music itself from that period, or the fact that he's become a cliche to be slagged over the years. If you catch my drift, it's like, okay, yeah, those songs.
Yeah, suck. Probably about equal.
Those songs suck, but okay, we get it. Those songs suck. You know, people like 20 years later still bring up his name as a kind of a punchline. So,
right. That, well, I mean, at least it seems like he's in on the joke, though.
I guess. I wouldn't know. But so, yeah, this is a skip. So moving on for your next one, 34, Is It Good to You by Heavy D and the Boys.
All right. And this is kind of New Jack Swing, kind of dance rap. It's kind of, I mean, almost one of the dominant styles of hip hop back around this era. And Nevermind kind of gets a lot of credit for killing off hair metal, but Chronic doesn't really get enough credit for killing off this style of rap, just kind of like the dancey style rap.
I agree, I didn't like hip-hop dance. That wasn't a very long trend, maybe 2 years or so. Mm-hmm. Like the original kind of 80s style rap to, you know, it sort of bridges the gap, I guess, to when West Coast and gangster rap, I mean, gangster rap was around from basically, you know, 88 or 89 on, but it didn't probably mm-hmm. enter the national consciousness until, because people talk about listening to NWA, like in the late 80s. Uh-huh. Yeah, there were some. I was one of them. I listened to NWA and Eazy-E back then, but there weren't that many people listening to gangster rap back then. It really didn't filter into like everybody's consciousness until at least a year or two later. But
yeah, that's true.
I thought, and Heavy D's album that came out like in 89 or 90, I don't remember the title, but it wasn't necessarily dance rap. I mean, it was more up tempo. It wasn't Public Enemy or anything, but I mean, it was, I thought they kind of sold out by this period. That was kind of my thought at the time.
Right. And it's, I mean, the lyrics are basically kind of going off of his overweight lover persona.
Yeah.
Just kind of the persona that he made out for himself. But, it's let's see, but this style just vanished completely within a year or two after this.
Yeah,
so
probably for the
kind of a relic of its time.
Yep, definitely.
But let's see, let's go on to number 33, which is Live for Loving You by Gloria Estefan.
Yeah, this is another skip for me. The only thing I will say about it is that at the beginning of the video, there's a claymation flamingo smoking a big, huge, looks like a joint. I don't think it actually is. It's probably like a cigar. So that's about it. I don't have much else to say about it. So,
okay.
My skips are coming early on this one, but anyway, number 32 is Keep Coming Back by Richard Marx.
Let's see. The debut of this video was actually a big deal on MTV at the time. Like, they were just like hyping up the world premiere of this video. And he did like a ridiculous interview on MTV News at the time where he was claiming that this album would be dark and that it was inspired by the seedy underbelly of Chicago.
Yeah.
And it just sounds like a mellower version of everything else that he put out. And you know what it actually does sound like? Sounds like Chris Gaines, who was Garth Brooks' rock alter ego.
Right, yeah.
So you're
at a little bit of a disadvantage over me because, as you mentioned, you were still living at home at that point, and I was not. And I don't recall that I may have had cable, but if I was, I wasn't watching MTV all the time. So I don't have any recollection of that at all. And I was kind of surprised to see. Richard Marx is another artist I don't associate with the 90s. I think of him as late 80s, but so I don't.
Yeah, this was like the tail end of his run. Like this album was like his last big album.
Right. So he fits in with a lot of these other artists who was, kind of at the end of the line. But I don't mind Richard Marx's 80s songs. Actually, most of them. I mean, not all of them, but they're fine. He's kind of Brian Adams.
His first album, he had almost like the entire all of the former members of the Eagles played on his debut album, essentially had them as a backing band.
Yeah.
So
that's good for him. But right. I don't really have much recollection of this one. So, but,
let's go on to your next one then, which would be number 31, Hearts Don't Think, They Feel by Natural Selection.
That would be Hearts Don't Think, parentheses, They Feel by Natural Selection.
Parentheses.
This one.
Yeah, you're correct.
This one's a skip. It's boring. And the only thing I could think of with this one is they should have made a different Darwin reference for their band name and just called it Descent of Man.
Okay.
Darwin humor. It doesn't get any better than that. So right. Now this is a skip, but it does allow me to segue into my long distance dedication. I get to go first this week, Matt.
Okay, what do you have?
I want to dedicate this one to every R&B group and rapper that was discovered by Michael Bivins of Belle Biv DeVoe and New Edition. This would be Oochie Coochie by MC Brains, which was I need to check. I didn't even find out where this was on the charts at the time. It would eventually get into the top 40. Oochie Coochie was in its third week on the chart at number 67, up 10 that week from MC Brains. And at the time in early 92, and this didn't last long either, but Belle Biv DeVoe were kind of the, I don't want to say that they were the kings of New Jack Swing, but they were, they were close to the throne, and they were cranking out all kinds of groups out of that they knew out of Philadelphia and other places. Among them, Boyz II Men, who will show up a few times on this countdown, who are probably more successful than Belle Biv DeVoe ultimately ended up being. But
oh yeah, definitely.
But they were cranking out like Another Bad Creation was like their version of New Edition, and MC Brains was a rapper they found. It was funny, I found the video for this, and it was just basically an old Yo MTV Raps clip, and I don't really care much about Oochie Coochie. It's basically just kind of a goof off rap that was kind of typical of the time. What I do want to pay tribute to, though, is speaking of Michael Bivins, is the greatest band that he discovered, which is Sudden Impact, who were featured in the Motown Philly video, where they had this thing where they all the bands that they discovered, or all the groups, kind of did their flex, like they kind of did cross their arms, and then they freeze framed, and then they put this stupid, very now dated cursive neon stuff across the top of their heads. And Another Bad Creation was one of them. Boyz II Men, before they had any hits, was another, and then there was Sudden Impact, who was included, and they were a bunch of white guys. It was basically their stab at, well, let's get some, blue-eyed soul, basically. And they were all in high school at the time, and they come on, and even at the time, I remember laughing at it, but they're coming out hard, we're fucking Sudden Impact. And, they're crossing their arms and looking all, tough and all that. And I was like, at the time, that Motown Philly was out in 91, and I was like, who the hell are Sudden Impact? And I kept waiting around because it seemed like everything that Belle Biv DeVoe touched at the time was, going to turn to gold. Never heard from them again. And I'm like, well, I'm not into that kind of R&B. Maybe I just missed it. Maybe they're a club hit or something like that. And no, they never even recorded an album. So
they did.
Not based on what I've found.
Not as Sudden Impact, Michael Bivins changed their name to White Boys.
Nice.
And the boys was spelled with a Z.
Of course. Which, well, I'll get to that in a second. But what was funny was, is I did in my research on Sudden Impact, I did find a story. I think they were from Virginia. And it was out of one of the Virginia newspapers when they showed up in the Motown Philly video. And one of the quotes cracked me up in this, because they were being compared to New Kids on the Block, who would have been the white boy, you know, boy band of the moment back then. And the quote says, this is from Aaron Kane, who is 18 years old and in Sudden Impact. He says, quote, "We have nothing against New Kids on the Block, but now it's our turn," unquote. So never happened for Sudden Impact, but they'll always be remembered for that cameo in that video. So, and getting back to MC Brains, yes, at the this under his this hit was under MC Brains, spelled normally, you know, with an S at the end, but he would later change his name to MC Brains with a Z at the end, because that's the shit you did in the 90s to be cool. So I don't know why we didn't change any of our names to have a Z at the end of it. Todd's would have been
Matt's cool. Yeah,
Matt's, that works. Golden's,
yeah.
We should have just gone with like gold, just with the gold theme, and, you know, Golds. We could have been Todd's Golds.
Yeah, MC that would have worked. Gold. Yeah,
that would have been cool.
Matt's Golds. Yeah.
So anyway, my long distance dedication goes out to Michael Bivins and his talent for discovering artists, whether they made that grade or not. So
okay,
that's what I got. So moving on, we go to number 30. Which is, as I scroll back up on my thing here, I'll Get By by Eddie Money, another artist I wouldn't associate with this time period. What do you got on this?
See, this is a skip, and it's basically adult contemporary nonsense. I was shocked that he had a hit in the 90s.
He just died recently, man. Why don't you have a heart?
I'm sorry. This song, it wasn't that good, Eddie. I'm sorry.
If I could walk on water, I would walk up there to Madison and kick your ass right now.
Okay.
Just saying. So I don't remember the song either, but right. I do dig. So I was really into Eddie Money in the late 80s. Remember I had his greatest hits?
You did. Yep. Yeah. Yeah.
That got sold for beer money at some point. But so.
So let's go to 29 here, which is by Boys.
Yes. This song cracks me up because most of Boys to Men songs are basically a cappella soul songs. I don't mind Boys to Men. I think they're pretty good, actually, for what they do. They never really tried to, like, get out of their lane, so to speak. They just sang straight up and were huge for it for, you know, like a pretty decent amount of the 90s. This song, however, which it was on their first album, which was Coolie High Harmony, this song is where they're trying to be lover men, and it's... The video for it's hilarious because they're like all the imagery of the time, you know, with women in bikinis with, you know, shaking their ass and stuff like that. And it's fucking Boys to Men. I mean, you know, there were some people who could pull off that image, and, you know, hindsight looking back at that, you know, those guys acting like they were like, you know, getting all the trim just doesn't fit, you know. I mean, and they're working up, they're trying to work up the image in the video, but you could tell that they're like half-assed about it, you know. The funniest thing is,
yeah,
you know, picking up the style of the time, there's several scenes where they're all in unison polka dot robes, like walking around like we're having an orgy over here. Boys to Men are hard, and we're getting down in our white polka dot robes with black dots on them. It's pretty awesome. Definitely out of character for their I'm not saying it's like explicit, because it's not, but it's you know, and I know a lot of people like Boys to Men, and I'm sure there were a lot of dates with Boys to Men music in it, but this was more definitely going, this was probably, you know, typical debut record where you probably don't have all the artistic control and that kind of thing. So it's not a bad song, though, actually. I mean, but it's just it's incongruent with Boys to Men's catalog, I guess. So, but I'll give them credit. Yeah. They I'm sure people, I mean, obviously it's on the chart, so people enjoyed it at the time, but so But moving on, number 28 is That's What Love Is For by Amy Grant. And I know you were listening to a shitload of Amy Grant back in the day.
Yeah, I definitely was. But anyway, I decided to skip this one. I have another Amy Grant song coming up later on, and this was the worst out of the two, so I decided to skip it.
On Amy Grant this week. Nice.
Yeah, I know. I know.
I'm glad you did, and I didn't have to do it. But
let's see. So moving on, 27, Love Me Up by Stacey Earle.
Yeah, Stacey Earle. This song, I didn't know anything about Stacey Earle because, again, this was – she didn't have a very long run. But I actually didn't mind this song. It was – it's definitely kind of a club song of that period. So a lot of, you know, kind of the house music influence to it. But it also had a little bit of a sophistopop bent to it, too. So there was like – it had the house beat, but there were strings in it. So, you know, it wasn't like a song I have later, which was Finally by C.C. Peniston. That'll come up later. But which that was basically a pure, you know, more or less house song. This, or, you know, whatever you want to call it. This had a little bit more of a polish to it. So I actually didn't mind it. And certainly not, it sounded a little bit different than some of the other R&B stuff that was out at the time. And this also beats the trend of many of the rest of the artists on the chart. This was actually her first hit. So didn't have that many after that, but she was at the beginning of her run. So not a bad song, actually.
Yeah, this was the first time I'd heard it, and it wasn't bad.
Yeah, it was all right.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not going to like go love it on Spotify or anything, but it was listenable.
Right.
Next up. This is a song I have zero recollection of. Number 26, I've Got a Lot to Learn About Love by The Storm.
And this is a skip, but I'm going to explain who this band was. They were the former members of Journey who weren't Steve Perry or Neil Schon.
Oh, God.
And it sounds exactly like Journey. They just hired a guy who sounded like Steve Perry.
What would 90s Journey sound like? That would be rough.
Exactly like 80s Journey.
Oh God.
Like so it's a skip.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
Let's see. 25, we have Vibology by Paula Abdul.
This would be a skip for me as well. This was the start of her slide, another one of these songs. It only got to 16 and she wouldn't have another top 10 song again for the rest of her career. But apart from that, it's not that interesting of a song, so I'm going to blow this.
Yeah, it's pretty lousy.
Yeah.
Actually.
So we're rolling pretty quick on this one. Number 24 is Broken Arrow by Rod Stewart.
Let's see. I skipped Rod at our first episode, and I felt bad about it, so I am going to talk about this one. It's adult contemporary. It sounds a lot like the kind of crap that Sting was putting out around the same era.
Yep.
It's the video had kind of a Losing My Religion feel to it, but I don't remember seeing it at the time. Maybe it was getting played on VH1. Who knows? But I was shocked to find out that it was a Robbie Robertson cover. And his version is a little bit rootsier, and Robertson didn't really sing for the band at all. Actually, they famously turned his microphone off during concerts, but he has kind of like a gravelly, almost like Tom Waits sounding voice. And his version's definitely in like definitely adult contemporary land too, but it's miles better than Rod's version. And shockingly, the Grateful Dead also covered this.
Jesus, I didn't know that.
But not one of Rod's best songs by any means. Kind of terrible, actually.
What if you had taken the lyrics of this song and put it over Do You Think I'm Sexy and then reversed it and put the lyrics of that song over the music to this one?
I think the lyrics for this would work over Do You Think I'm Sexy because, I mean, much better song.
No, I'm saying like the yep. version of Broken Arrow. And 90s crap adult contemporary version of Do You Think I'm Sexy. I bet Do You Think I'm Sexy would have been a bigger hit.
Yeah, probably. I'd say
I have no idea why I thought of that. That was weird.
Right. See, but let's move along here to Wild Side by Marky Mark and the Funky Bunch.
Yeah. We got Marty. This is I loved looking up this song because, first of all, I had completely forgotten that Marky Mark and the Funky Bunch had rapped over Lou Reed's Take a Walk on the Wild Side. So,
and this was the first time I'd heard Lou Reed's Walk on the Wild Side. This is first time I was actually aware of that song.
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
That's disturbing, but. The video is hilarious because it's pretty prototypical, you know, rap imagery, R&B imagery from the time. It's in black and white because, of course, why wouldn't it be? At the beginning, and, you know, a lot of videos, of course, well into the 90s had imagery that, frankly, had nothing to do with the song whatsoever. Like, at the beginning, they're burning an American flag, loading crack pipes because... I mean, he sort of follows the theme of Walk on the Wild Side, where he's talking about people who, you know, basically, you know, fucked up their lives or you know, on the wild side, so to speak. there's a guy in a cemetery miming the sax track from as if he's playing it.
Oh, yeah.
Like that part. Yeah. Huh. And you got Marky Mark just going, huh, a lot over the top of Lou Reed's sample. But and of course, you know, Marky Mark is either wearing no shirt whatsoever or he's wearing this dopey ass kind of bomber jacket with a hoodie. So and a White Sox cap, because you couldn't be hard back then if you weren't wearing a White Sox cap. So Marky Mark's run wasn't as long as I remembered. I mean, they basically were really only relevant on the charts for about a year. But of course, Marky Mark, Mark Wahlberg, later on became a very successful actor. And there's probably a ton of people who have no idea, you know, if you came of age, you know, from about 2000 onward, that he was a rapper at all, which, but we remember Marky Mark and how good his shit was. But what I wanted to know is what happened to the rest of the Funky Bunch, especially Hector the Booty Inspector. So
I wasn't aware that, I mean, there was actually Funky Bunch members. I mean, I knew he had like background. I'm assuming they're just his background dancers.
That was his posse, B. Okay. Hector the Booty Inspector. I just wanted to say his name. I never actually bothered to look up these days. So maybe he and Marky Mark are hanging out on the set of Ted 3 or something like that. Who knows?
Right.
So anyway, it's a relic of its time. I've never really heard Mark Wahlberg address the Funky Bunch era recently. I'm sure he has. It's not like I seek out Mark Wahlberg shit, but
right.
I wonder how he feels about his legacy as a rapper.
I don't know. I'm assuming that he just like doesn't mention it at all. I mean,
I don't know. I'll bet he thinks it's pretty cool. I mean, you know, so unfortunately it really wasn't very cool. I mean, he's lucky Boogie Nights came around, because he did some movies before Boogie Nights. I remember going to one of them in the theater. We went on a date. Kathleen and I, my wife, went on a date with a friend of ours. Or no, we saw it on, it was a straight to video. We were at his house. It was like a double date movie night. And it was Mark Wahlberg was in it, Alicia Silverstone. No, wait. Reese Witherspoon, I think, was in it. And it was about he played some psycho dude stalking his girlfriend, but he was still kind of in Marky Mark mode, because he was like, you know, he was like a rap. He was like from the other side of the tracks. He was into rap and shit. And it was, I think it was called Fear.
Yeah, it was Fear. It was Fear. Yeah.
It was a terrible movie. So he's lucky Boogie Nights came around to create a more respectable career for him, because he was good in Boogie Nights. But Anyway, moving on. Number 22 is Good For Me by Amy Grant.
Okay, and this was Grant's first pop crossover album, and she obviously caught a lot of flack from, like, the contemporary Christian crowd, but it's squeakiest clean pop ever. I mean, it probably could just pass as contemporary Christian music.
Was this before Baby Baby?
This was her single after Baby Baby.
I mean, I think it would have been funny if she would have just... Because apparently, didn't she, like... It was, like, supposedly against her faith to go pop or something like that. I think...
I mean, something like that.
I heard that on one of the... I think I heard it on one of the 80s countdowns that I listened to on XM. But I think it would have been funny if she just would have gone all the way and she would have gone New Jack Swing.
Well,
I mean, like, the whole imagery with... Like, every rap video or R&B video at the time always had three dancers, like, in a line, dancing over the top of, like, some horrible green screen graphic.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And Amy Grant should have done that.
She definitely should have.
That would have been a...
But one story I have to bring up from this song is she name-checks Mario Andretti in the song. And Mario Andretti actually struck up a friendship with her because of that. And I'm kind of wondering if he did the same thing with the Beastie Boys.
Exactly what I was just wondering, because he gets name checked in Shadrock, right?
He does, yeah. Yeah, because he always drives his car well.
Yes, he does. So,
but this peaked at number 8. Wasn't as big of a hit as Baby Baby, but still kind of a big hit. It's a decent pop song, I guess.
Fair enough. I have nothing more to say.
And moving on to number 21, we have somebody who appeared on the Grammys tonight.
Yeah, I saw that.
Bonnie Raitt with I Can't Make You Love Me.
This is a skip for me, not because it's a bad song. It's actually not a bad song. It's a ballad. I just don't have much of anything interesting to say about it.
Okay.
So.
All right.
That moves us to number 20, Remember the Time by Michael Jackson, right in your wheelhouse.
Right, and this was the second single off of Dangerous, and Michael Jackson had an insane pull over MTV at the time, and also Epic Records, his label, also had an insane pull over MTV because they had Michael Jackson, and... couple artists from Epic got basically their start because Epic threatened to withhold the Michael Jackson videos. Couple of them of note, Living Color and Pearl Jam. And some stories about Michael Jackson with MTV. He came up with the nickname the King of Pop by himself.
So.
And he insisted that every VJ referred to him as King of Pop twice a week, and they had to submit video evidence of this to Jackson.
Jesus.
And at one point, Steve Isaacs, one of the VJs, kind of made a joke about his skin lightening, and as a punishment, they were forced to have a Michael Jackson weekend. So, just kind of like the insane pull that he had over MTV. But this song was kind of, Michael Jackson was kind of going deep into New Jack Swing at the time. And this was co-written by Teddy Riley, who kind of originated the genre. And the video was one of the most expensive videos ever made. It was directed by John Singleton, had cameos by Eddie Murphy, Magic Johnson and Iman, and had a lot of early CGI.
Yeah,
so
remember that.
And it's, I mean, decent for this era of Michael Jackson, but it's definitely not one of my favorites. I wasn't really a fan of the Dangerous album, to tell you the truth.
Yeah. Who were the MTV VJs in 92? I might be able to name like, God, I don't. Ricky Rackman would have been doing Headbangers Ball, I guess.
Yeah, I'm wondering if him or Dave Kendall were exempt from that yeah, rule.
Kendall would have done 120 minutes, right? See, they were moving away from the VJ concept of the 80s. They were becoming, they were getting specialized.
But Steve Isaacs was there. Adam Curry was still there. I think Julie Brown.
Oh, yeah.
Kennedy. Julie
Brown, definitely, yeah.
Who else was there? Bill Bellamy might have been there by that point. Daisy Fuentes.
Yeah.
Think Pauly Shore.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah. Huh. They're not quite as iconic as the 80s ones for some reason, but.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely not.
That, I believe, also moves us into your long-distance dedication.
It does, and
I think I already know what you're going to pick, but go ahead.
And this goes out to all the people bound for Moo Moo Land. at number 70, we have KLF featuring Tammy Wynette with Justified and Ancient. And this is, hands down, one of the weirdest collaborations ever. The KLF were the brainchild of Bill Drummond and Jimmy Cauty, and they were basically reacting to what they thought was ridiculous and excessive about pop music by making music that was more ridiculous and more excessive. And prior to this, they had a band called the Time Lords, and they managed to have a fluke number one single in the UK with Doctor in the TARDIS, which was basically rock and roll part two. And they sang Doctor Who, hey, yeah. Doctor Who.
I've heard that.
Over it. And in the aftermath, they wrote an instructional book on how to write a number one called The Manual. And it includes such advice as, if you're a musician, stop playing your instrument. Even better, sell the junk. And it actually did inspire another band to hit number one in Austria. And their song was ABBA's SOS with Yodeling. But anyway, bringing it up to 92, Justified and Ancient was a stadium house track, which was their term. And Tammy Wynette was on lead vocals, and the lyrics were kind of built off their strange mythology about themselves. There's references to traveling the world in ice cream vans, trains bound for Moo Moo Land. I always kind of wondered how much money they threw at Tammy to get her to do this. But anyway, it ended up making it all the way to number 11. And now, they disappeared on purpose shortly after this.
That made it to 11 before, America?
Yeah.
Wow, okay.
But before they did this, they did like a going away performance at an award show in the UK. And they did a death metal version of one of their songs, and they shot blanks into the audience and played an announcement that said the KLF has left the music industry. And after that, they did a film of them burning all the money they made from KLF. So it's good, weird stuff.
Yeah, those guys are, I remember the video for it. I remember Tammy Wynette was in it, and they like, it's almost like they kind of put her in a position like where they're worshiping her or something, if that's what I remember.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Yeah, that's what it was.
This isn't what I thought you were going to pick, by the way.
What did you think?
I thought you were going to pick Mind Playing Tricks on Me by the Geto Boys.
Actually, my second pick was Don't Cry.
By Guns N' Roses?
Guns N' Roses, okay. Yeah.
I just thought you were going to pay tribute to Bushwick Bill beating up the concrete in that video.
Yeah, I mean, that was number three, actually. That was third possibility.
Houston gangster rap.
Right. All right, we have number 19, Keep It Coming by Keith Sweat.
Well, it doesn't get much more New Jack Swing than Keith Sweat. He's kind of, along with Belle Biv DeVoe, maybe Bobby Brown, I guess, and a few others, he's probably right in the wheelhouse of this sound, which was so dominant from you know, about 1980, late, you know, 1989 to about, yeah, it wasn't much longer than this, maybe 92 or 93. And this had, like I mentioned earlier, this had every early 90s video trope of an R&B or rap video. It had the dancers over the top of the green screen, and the horribly dated graphics. And, you know, it's, pretty prototypical of its time. And actually, but New Jack Swing was, its time, as I mentioned, wasn't very much longer. You know, some of the West Coast beats and stuff like that were about to take over and really kind of put it to pasture. And Keith Sweat himself, this was one of his last hits. He had a mid-90s. He didn't have any hits or any big hits anyway for about a 3 or 4 year period. And then he did come back with Twisted and Nobody in 96. So, but when I think of New Jack Swing, I think of Keith Sweat. And he just kind of, you know, most of his songs sound are basically the same. But he was definitely a archetype of that period, and appropriate that he's on this countdown. So,
yeah.
Moving on for you, number 18 is Set Adrift on Memory Bliss by PM Dawn.
Right, and since we mentioned the SoundScan era in the intro, little trivia question, but this was the very first number one single of the SoundScan era. And these guys were hyped to death as the next big thing on MTV at the time. And they're kind of hippie-ish type of rap, and later on in their other in their albums after this, they kind of went a little Christian, kind of like presaging what Kanye West is kind of doing now. But this song was built on a sample of True by Spandau Ballet, and Spandau Ballet's lead singer Tony Hadley actually has a cameo in the video. And when I was listening to it, I mean, this is probably the first time I'd heard it in at least 25 years or so, but I was shocked by how well it's aged. It's actually a pretty decent song.
There was a lot of hippie rap or hippie R&B, like bands that kind of traded in that imagery a little bit. Mm-hmm. I mean, to some degree, for whatever reason, I associate PM Dawn with Soul to Soul for some reason, even though I don't know that their sound was all that similar. Maybe they had similar imagery, but you also had...
They both had the dreadlocks going.
So. Right. Yes, yeah. I remember about it. And then you also had Arrested Development, which wasn't necessarily... I mean, they kind of traded in... They were different in the respect that they weren't trying to be gangsta. In fact, they were probably anti-gangsta, if anything. But they had a certain hippie, they were going for more of a Sly and the Family Stone hippie vibe. And I'm not just saying that because they sampled one of their songs, but they kind of had that ethos about them. And PM Dawn was kind of like that too. I could never get into it. I always wondered what the hype was all about with this song, but but I haven't listened to it in a long time either.
See, and they were victims of kind of like an infamous incident where Prince B, the lead rapper, dissed KRS-One in an interview, and KRS-One showed up at one of their shows and went on stage and essentially took over their show and just like did his set, because the diss was Prince B said KRS is a teacher, but what is he a teacher of? And he said, I came on the stage to teach them respect.
rap beefs were I can't say they were innocent back then. You know, there were several that got violent, but
yeah,
that one kind of, that cracks me up. The fact that PM Dawn was even doing a diss track kind of is funny, but.
Right.
So.
Well, let's move on here. And this was actually performed at the Grammys tonight. It's So Hard to Say Goodbye to Yesterday by Boyz II Men.
I know they were on the Grammys. I didn't watch that part. Did they do this song?
They did perform this song. Yeah.
Okay, well, that's good, because I actually kind of like this song. It certainly wouldn't have been in my wheelhouse at the time, where I was pretty much exclusively listening, trying to catch up like a lot of college kids do on the stuff they didn't know about, you know, from rock and roll and stuff. But even at the time, I thought this was a pretty cool song. It kind of, you know, like I said, that they're the song from earlier, you know, was really not prototypical Boyz II Men, but this song is definitely prototypical Boyz II Men, just basically a straight up a cappella song over a little bit of groove. So you know, like I said earlier, they had a style, they stuck with it, and they did it well. And this song's a good example of that. I mean, even I'll Make Love to You, which came later, which sounds like a Lover Man song, but it really wasn't. As ubiquitous and after a while kind of annoying as that song was, it still, you know, was their, it was their thing and they perfected it. And so, and I think they're one of the few groups from that period, few R&B groups from that period that have really maintained longevity since then. I mean, I'll bet Boys to Men, if they went out and toured right now, could probably do really well. You know, I don't know that they're going to fill arenas or anything like that, but they
might do that. I mean,
I could see them
doing that.
I mean, I could see them being at like a large, like when I went to the Fox Theater in Atlanta, that'd be like a perfect venue to see them at. Like a, that place seats about 5,000 or 6,000, that kind of thing. So,
yeah.
So respect to Boys to Men. I think they're better than Belle Biv DeVoe, who found them.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah.
And they had more of a timeless sound to them. So, you know, they were kind of cool. I never owned any of their albums, but I didn't they were on. So, much love to Boys to Men.
Okay.
Moving on, not much love to this song though. 16 is Adam's Groove by MC Hammer.
Let's see. Well, this is kind of a forgettable song from a forgettable movie franchise. And Hammer was already like totally overexposed by this point. And this was his last top 10 hit. And in the video, it's, I mean, kind of common for like soundtracks at the time. It was just basically Hammer and then they like switched to the Addams Family. But in this one, he actually kind of interacts with the Addams Family. He gets beheaded by Christina Ricci at some point. Angelica Houston's flirting with him. He does a sword fight with Raul Julia. But, yeah, terrible song. Kind of, like, has the same cadence as the Addams Family theme. Not... definitely not a fan. I kind of hated it at the time too.
Oh yeah, it was bad. I mean, this to me, this song to me is to MC Hammer as Ghostbusters 2's theme is to Bobby Brown.
I love On Your Own, to tell you the truth.
That song's, I mean, I love it because it's funny to laugh at, but you know, just kind of a sellout, you know, cash in type of song. That's what it, or rap in this case. But I get my shot at MC Hammer a little bit later, but
okay.
So
all right, well, let's move on to 15, which is No Son of Mine by Genesis.
It's probably good that I got this song because the story I have about this song is, so we're talking about the charts that were in February of beginning of February 92. So most of these songs we're talking about would have been out. Most of these albums were released in the latter part of 91. So Christmas time comes along in 1991. And, you know, I was asked what I wanted for Christmas. And I said, well, why don't you get me some CDs? And I think I gave my dad a list of CDs. I may have, or I may not have, I don't remember. But you know, what I would have been listening to at the time would have been stuff that, you know, you basically have to go out to a music store to do. And my dad wasn't probably going to be doing that. You know, he was going to be going to the, whatever was in the mall at the time. So, so I get my presents for Christmas. And I had had a period of time in the 80s when I was in high school where I was really heavy duty into Genesis. Like I had bought, like in my early, when I first got a CD player, which would have been Christmas of 88, I bought several Genesis albums. I think at one point at that time, I had all the Phil Collins solo.
I actually have a story about this.
Well, let me.
Okay.
Let me finish mine. But
okay.
So, but by 1991, I'd kind of faded out of that because Phil Collins had definitely gotten soft with the album after No Jacket Required. And my musical taste had moved on. And so I remember Christmas of 91 and I open it up and I get the We Can't Dance album by Genesis. And everybody was excited, like, yeah, we got the, you know, the new Genesis album. Like, And, you know, you don't want to be an asshole and say, oh, I don't really care for them anymore. I had to like play it off. So I'm like, oh, yeah, okay, cool. And so I remember I did listen to it, and I was like, oh my gosh, this is just not for me anymore. And, you know, Genesis's sound had changed too. I still do listen to like early, like late 70s, early Genesis. Like, I will listen occasionally to their so-called peak, you know, art rock prog period in the mid 70s too, once in a while. But, you know, I'll still listen to like the Duke album or Abacab or something like that, which are, you know, for original Genesis fans was a sellout. But for me, you know, I think that's kind of their sweet spot, I guess. But yeah, they weren't in that territory by 1991. They were definitely into adult contemporary mode. And this song is one of many songs written by Genesis members that was just depressing and about depressing source material. Like the whole gist of it is the son of the protagonist in the song returns home, and then he gets basically ostracized by the people he was returning to. Mm-hmm. So I have no idea why these types of songs spoke to people. Like The Living Years that Mike Rutherford wrote for Mike and the Mechanics is that was a tribute to his father, I think, but it's so maudlin. I don't get why people like latched onto those songs. A lot of Phil Collins' solo songs were written, you know, really kind of have a depressing backstory to him, because for some of the albums he did, he was depressed, especially his early ones where he had just gone through a divorce. He was, you know, kind of the songs were darker. Some of the songs are overtly dark, but, you know, he wasn't always coming from like a sunny place. So I have no idea what people, you know, maybe it was just because Phil Collins was so popular and, you know, he was on his way down in popularity, but, you know, he's at such a huge height at his peak that, you know, this and that album produced several hits actually, but definitely not, you know, you wouldn't throw this, people are not going to remember this song as, you know, like the best of Genesis. So right. What's your story about this? I'm curious.
Okay. Well, you got a CD player before Dad did. And Dad just bought a CD player, and I think you must have been, I don't know where you were at this time, but Dad didn't have any CDs, and we were sitting down for breakfast, and Dad was like, hey, why don't you grab one of your brother's CDs and we'll play it during breakfast? And the only two options were Eazy-E, Eazy Does It, and Genesis Abacab. So obviously I picked Genesis. And put it in there. Dad's making breakfast. I sit down, start eating. He sits like the plate on the table. He just kind of mutters to himself, "God, I hate fucking Genesis," and walks away.
Well, actually, that brings to mind another story. And it might have been at the same time, so I may have actually been there. Our dad was, our mom had passed away, and our dad got remarried in the late 80s. And his wife was someone who tried to, probably painfully so, you know, keep up with trends and stuff like that is probably the nice way to put it. And Eazy-E's Does It album, I believe, was the second or third CD I ever bought. And she's like, hey, why don't you play that Eazy-E album? I'm like, wait, what? I go, are you sure about that? I go, this thing's really explicit. And she's like, oh yeah, no, I'm cool. You know, she's trying to be, you know, sort of cool with it. So I do remember having another breakfast where we literally listened, like ate breakfast over Eazy Does It.
Oh God, I don't remember that.
So yeah, it was like, you know, Dope Man and shit like that. I mean, it was, and I'm sitting here thinking, and she's like, yeah, this stuff is really, you know, and I don't know what she actually thought of it, but she was like saying nice things. It's like, oh, so this is where music is headed, that kind of thing. And it was so, you know, I don't think our dad was around. I don't remember if he was or not, but I just remember blaring Eazy Does It, over dinner or breakfast or something like that. So yeah, but So, but yeah, this song, the, you know, No Son of Mine is not one of the, you know, God bless whoever got it for me, but it was, you know, by then I kind of moved on in my taste. So,
right. But
that happens. So,
yeah.
Moving on. Number 14 is To Be With You by Mr. Big.
Yep. And this was, Mr. Big was formed by Billy Sheehan, who was the bass player for David Lee Roth. And he was kind of highly regarded by bass players. He won Bass Player of the Year like 6 or 7 years in a row. But problem with like guys like that is usually they put out music that's total crap. And this isn't really an exception to that. And it's an acoustic ballad, and it's kind of the last gasp of hair metal, like the last huge hair metal hit. And it went to number one towards the end of this month, and still gets a lot of play on like adult contemporary stations, and it's just crap.
Yeah, I think you're discounting my boys Jackal and Ugly Kid Joe, who came after this.
Yeah, I guess you're
right. Hair metal went a little longer than people think. I mean, it went, you know, I've always contended that the grunge and alternative stuff really didn't start to really hit people's consciousness till about 93. So there's this weird transition period in 92 where some of that stuff was starting to come about, but you still had shit like Mr. Big or Ugly Kid Joe and stuff like that on the charts still. At 92 is a weird year.
Firehouse was around then too.
Right. And as yeah. mentioned, as hair metal developed, there was this weird acoustic period of hair metal that was strange in retrospect. Like Mr. Big was one of them. To some degree, Tesla was one of them, although I actually like Tesla.
Extreme.
You know, Extreme. All the bands seemed to do like an acoustic song in this period. It was like, we got to move on from all this babes and drugs and all this shit. We need to, you know, if we throw on an acoustic song, we'll sound more serious. LA Guns is another one. Didn't they have an acoustic song? I think
they did. Yeah.
Yeah. So that was kind of a weird development of the hair metal stuff. But so this song was, I'm not going to argue with you. It wasn't like a great song, but there was a lot worse. I'll put it that way.
Okay.
What's next? See, hit me with this.
Number 13, Too Legit to Quit by MC Hammer.
1991 Falcons in the house, Matt. you know who's in my posse? Tim McIver, Brian Jordan, Deion Sanders, Andre Rison, Eric Pegram, all those boys, Jerry Glanville. I'm bringing them all. They're all in my posse because Too Legit to Quit. That's what I remember.
They're all in the video for this, right?
I don't remember if they're in the video or not, but I do remember them kind of adopting this as their theme. The 91 Falcons made the playoffs, which they hadn't done in quite a while at that point. And of course, with Deion Sanders was kind of their spirit animal, I suppose. And then as now, it was kind of a, you know, all eyes on me type of vibe to Deion Sanders. But they kind of, this was like their theme song. So they would like, they would chant this in the locker room after they got a big win. So, apart from that, the song was actually, it was definitely MC Hammer's last truly big one that was his. I mean, Adam's Groove was, you know, a movie song, but,
right.
I just thought it was annoying. I mean, because all it was, it wasn't really much rhyming. It was just it was really a chant is what it was.
Pretty much.
I mean, there's some chorus, but it's not like some of his earlier stuff where he was actually rapping more in it, which I'm not saying his early stuff was that great either. But but as you mentioned earlier, this was on its way down, I believe. Adam's Groove was on its way up. And that was pretty much it for him for a while until the glorious Pumps and a Bump came a few years later where he tried to go be contemporary and go more gangsta.
Yeah.
Pumps
yeah.
and a Bump. Pumps and a Bump. Pumps and a Bump. We like the girls with the pumps and a bump. That song was... I give him credit for trying, though. So
Right.
So yeah, much love to the 91 Falcons, who did win a playoff game. People forget they beat the Saints in New Orleans, so that's a big rivalry game. And then they lost to the eventual
Redskins, Super Bowl
champion,
right?
Redskins, yeah, in a mud bowl in Washington. So we know our sports on here too. So you're going to get a little sports when it comes up, when appropriate. So anyway, moving on. Number 12, which I accidentally researched this song because I screwed up and thought it was mine, but it's yours. And it's okay. The Way I Feel About You by Karen White.
Okay. This is my last skip, and it sounds vaguely like Janet Jackson, and I don't remember it, really.
I kind of remembered it when I researched it, and I'll only say that this was another artist. This was her last hit as well.
Yeah, I can see last that.
Hit, yep. So.
See, number 11, U2 with Mysterious Ways.
See, I hear this song, and this was on the Octoon Baby album, which was a change in style for U2, where they went a little bit more electronic than they had for Rattle and Hum, which was the album that came before this. But I don't know what the legacy of Octoon Baby. Octoon Baby put out a lot of hits, even better than The Real Thing was on this. One was on this, and I'm leaving another song out. The Fly was on this, wasn't it?
Yeah, The Fly was the first single, I think.
Yeah, so at the time, it seemed like, you know, oh, they're really moving in a new direction, and they kind of went with this new imagery where they were painfully ironic and all that, which had been different from the overly earnest U2 of the 80s. And at the time, it seemed like it was like a change in style and they were moving in a different direction. It was very popular. I don't know what the legacy, though, of that period is. It doesn't seem like that, because U2 went on to move into different things. In a way, you could say this was, you know, a stylistic move that worked at the time. I don't know that it works now. I don't know how many of those songs. I don't think any of those songs are bad, but I don't.
Do you still hear them on these songs on the? I mean, Mysterious Ways gets played every once in a while on the radio.
Yeah, Mysterious Ways probably more so than the others, but I wonder, you know, that image didn't last that long for U2 though. It's not like they influenced other bands to kind of follow their lead either. So,
yeah, you're right about that.
I mean, I guess it's like any other band that kind of adopts an image for a brief period. I'm not sure how lasting it really was. It was very popular at the time, and you know, certainly it was probably the most relevant period of U2 in the 90s, I would say. They had more hits in the 90s, of course, but so I was not enamored with this song. I like some of the other songs off that album better, but you know, it was a big hit. Number 10 for you, Matt, is Tell Me What You Want Me to Do by Tevin Campbell.
See, Tevin Campbell started out his career as a Prince protege. He appeared in the movie Graffiti Bridge, and he did a song called Round and Round, which ended up becoming hit. And it was kind of him almost doing a young Stevie Wonder, young Michael Jackson impersonation over kind of a New Jack Swing beat. And this was the album that came out afterwards, and his voice had changed by this point. And he was, I mean, kind of like PM Dawn, he was kind of seen as like a rising star too. And the album that this came off of, most of the tracks were written and produced by Narada Michael Walden, who was Whitney Houston's producer at the time. So kind of like the similar type feel to it, that sort of R&B. But I mean, it's okay, I guess. I mean, it's just kind of what it is.
I've never seen Graffiti Bridge.
I've never seen it all the way. I've just basically seen the clip that they used for that video, actually.
Yeah, I've never seen it. I've seen Purple Rain. It's been a while. I've seen Purple Rain, but I've never seen Graffiti Bridge. Never really wanted to.
Yeah, I really never really had any interest in seeing it. So, but let's move on here to number 9, which is Black or White by Michael Jackson.
Well, you talked a lot about Michael Jackson and what he was recording in this period. So what I'll talk about is what I thought about this song at the time. And like I said, I was listening to classic rock, and in particular, the Rolling Stones were and are big for me. So I had bought every Rolling Stones album from, I think, Between the Buttons on to every album they had to that point. So even like Dirty Work and Undercover and stuff like that, which are not, you know, well thought of albums. And I remember hearing Black and White, and I was pissed because I was convinced that they ripped off a song called by the Rolling Stones called It Must Be Hell, which is like the last track on the Undercover album. The mm-hmm. guitar riff is exact is was that, you know, that basically is the hook for the song. Was I thought it was lifted almost straight up from that song. In fact, I think at the time I thought it might have even been sampled out of that song. And I'm mm-hmm. like, come on, Michael Jackson, you're better than that. You can come up with something more original. And I remembered that when this song came up for me, and I was like, well, I must have just been, you know, full of myself and full of my own tastes and stuff like that. I mean, I was like, that couldn't even be close. So I went back and re-listened to both songs, because I don't think I've listened to the Undercover album in 25 years. I mean, it's not a very good album. And I have to say, I got to stick by my original assessment. I mean, that's straight up basically that guitar riff from that song. So I thought I remembered people, like Stones fans anyway, mentioned there was no internet, you know, message boards or anything like that at the time. But I do remember somebody mentioning that in a report. I couldn't find any documentation of it, like in the internet. Of course, the internet didn't mm-hmm. really exist in 1992 in the form it does now. But anyway, it is a catchy song. It does borrow from that guitar riff. But I mean, that seems to me to be a kind of a pithy criticism now, you know, considering how many songs in hindsight. At the time, I was very, it's weird because I was anti-sampling at the time, and actually in hindsight I think I was wrong about that, because sampling has actually turned me on to a lot of music I never would have heard otherwise. So so I'll forgive Michael Jackson for, I don't even know if he meant to rip off the Rolling Stones. I think Slash actually played guitar on that, so maybe he ripped off.
He did, yeah.
But anyway, you know, probably his last truly iconic song, I think. I know Remember the Time was on this earlier, which is, you know, also memorable. But mm-hmm. this one was big. It was the first song off of Dangerous. And so.
See, it had a really controversial video at the time, because he's, at one point, like, the song stops. It's one of Michael Jackson's, like, kind of extended videos, but the song drops out and he's smashing a car and grabbing his crotch for about 2 minutes or so.
Yeah, for no really apparent reason. So
I think he like morphs into a panther after that.
Yeah, I at the time I was like, I don't understand why people think this is controversial. I just thought it was stupid. I mean, I didn't really understand.
It is stupid.
What
he
was going for, but. Anyway, moving on, this is a big one. Number 8, Smells Like Teen Spirit by Nirvana.
And this is the track that changed everything. And I remember seeing the video for the first time like it was yesterday. I got home from school, turned on MTV, and they were playing typical early 90s MTV fare, Extreme, CNC Music Factory, and stuff like that. And then there's this riff and a shot of a guy stomping his feet on the ground with Converse Chucks, and there's three scruffy dudes dressed up in like thrift store clothes rocking out, and there's cheerleaders with like unshaved pits, tattoos, and like anarchy symbols. And I was like, what is this? And it started getting softer. He's mumbling, what's this guy saying? And then, like, oh shit, he's yelling now. What's this? This is great. I mean, I was floored. I immediately wanted to see it again. And I wasn't alone, because within a week or two, you started seeing kids at my school wearing Nirvana t-shirts. And Geffen only expected Nevermind would sell about 100,000 copies total. And they actually ran out of copies at one point, and they stopped manufacturing all their other albums and just shifted to making Nevermind to keep up the demand. I mean, they're huge.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty sure my entire middle school watched them when they played on SNL a couple months after this came out. And it was probably the closest thing late Gen X had to the Beatles on Ed Sullivan. I mean, I might be exaggerating it a little bit. And I mean, because of the meteoric success, I mean, a lot of people held them in suspicion. There is this clip of Headbangers Ball that I stumbled onto while I was researching this. And Ricky Rackman is just like barely concealing his contempt for him. And part of it might have been for the fact that Kurt was wearing like a yellow prom dress in the interview.
Well, and, you know, we know now what maybe Ricky Rackman suspected at the time. They were a threat to the order of, you know, hair metal and heavy metal generally. I mean, which is really odd because my introduction to this song was different than yours. Since I was at college, I wasn't watching MTV. And so things like that weren't filtering to me as clearly as they would have been to you. And I actually heard it through my metal friends who dug the riff of it and stuff. So I remember hearing Nirvana first through them. And, you know, in a way, I kind of had the same initial reaction as Rackman did, because I was like, oh, here, you know, is this where I want metal to go? And see, I thought of them as a metal band first. Mm-hmm. And of course, a lot of grunge did trade in metal, you know, imagery, I mean, maybe not imagery, but musical tropes. And it wasn't until I heard some of their other songs that I kind of came around on Nirvana. To this day, I'm not a huge fan of this song. I mean, I understand why it's big. I don't dislike it.
Right.
But I didn't really get on board with Nirvana until In Utero came out, which to me is still their master. The thing about Nirvana that I like is they got better as they went along. And
I think they peaked with Nevermind, actually.
See, you and I have always disagreed about that. I think In Utero is, I think that's one of the best albums of the 90s, period. But you know, your generation can speak to that. Me being early or mid period or whatever, peak Gen X, whatever you want to say. Certainly, you know, the music is made by people of my age, but yeah, it was, turned out to be a big deal. And, you know, for a while, when you're at college and you're in the college bubble, you're like, what the hell? Why is this, you know, such a big thing? So took me a little bit more time to get on board, but,
right.
Certainly.
And, as for the song itself, the title comes from a brand of deodorant, and it was something that Kathleen Hanna from Bikini Kill spray painted on Kurt's wall. He was dating her bandmate at the time, and she used Teen Spirit brand deodorant. So she wrote "Kurt smells like Teen Spirit" on his wall. And Kurt didn't like pick up on the fact that it was a brand of deodorant. It was like, oh, that's a great song title.
Yeah.
And he didn't find out until after it had become a hit, and he got like barraged with questions about Teen Spirit deodorant.
Yeah. What's next?
Next we have Finally by CC Peniston.
Yeah, I don't want to waste too much time on this. It's a club song that definitely would have been off my radar at the time, although I do remember hearing it quite a bit. It was CC Peniston's first and biggest hit. She never had another top 10, but she did have 5 dance number one. So she was big in the clubs and, you know, kind of prototypical of the time, you know, definitely a house influence to it, but, you know, not one that really spoke to me, but not, you know, not a bad song. It's kind of lived over its time. So, which gets us to number 6, which I'm jealous that you got this one. I'm Too Sexy by Right Said Fred.
Okay, and this is a straight up novelty song, and it's fitting because Right Said Fred were actually named after a novelty song, early 60s novelty song. But anyway, Right Said Fred were brothers, the Fairbrass brothers, and they owned a gym. And they wrote this song to kind of mock their patrons, who they thought were a little too narcissistic. Like, I'm too sexy for my car, I'm too sexy for my cat, so on. And it actually went to number one the week after this. So this was their only top 40 hit in the States. They had another song called Don't Talk, Just Kiss, which I assumed made the top 40. It got a lot of play on MTV, but didn't quite make it. But kind of one hit wonders in America, but they did have more success in Europe, especially Germany. I think they actually did have another number one in Germany after this, but yeah, Right Said Fred.
Yep. Campy video. They were outwardly campy and it was funny.
Yeah, basically. Yeah. That's what they were going for.
Yep.
Right. So number five, we have Can't Let Go by Mariah Carey.
Yeah. I don't want to talk about the song much. I just want to, the thing that always bugged me about Mariah Carey is that her squeal, her like high pitch kind of trademark that she had in a lot of her songs. I always got into it with people at the time. I was like, man, Mariah Carey can sure. Some of my friends were into Mariah Carey and I was like, man, they were like, she can really sing. I'm like, how is that singing? I mean, what is that adding to this? Like that squeal that she does, you know, I can think of other singers that had range in their voice, like going back, you know, into the 70s, Al Green used to really work the range between low and high in his songs. But I always felt like those had a purpose within the song. I never felt like her squeal or whatever it was had any purpose at all. I just thought it was showing off.
Yeah, I think you're right about that.
That was always kind of my impression. So that's my shot. Sorry, Mariah Carey fans, that's my shot at her. So,
okay.
Number four for you is Diamonds and Pearls by Prince and the New Power Generation.
Let's see, and this was a duet between Prince and New Power Generation's background vocalist, keyboardist, Rosie Gaines. And she was also prominently featured on Cream, which came out before this.
Yeah, which was below the top 40, still on the chart, actually.
Oh, okay.
Yep.
right. But anyway, this was the only album that she appeared on, which is a shame because she was a very good foil for Prince, especially in this song, because Prince is kind of whispering his lyrics and Gaines is kind of like belting him out in kind of a gospel style. And it's kind of an interesting contrast. Pretty good song. I actually really like this era of Prince.
Yeah. I did my, this was the one song I probably wasn't a big fan of, but I was a big fan of Cream and, you know, we listened to this at this album definitely was in my wheelhouse. Cause we had this album. My roommate and I at the time had this. So this got played a lot in my apartment. So I do remember listening to this quite a bit. So, what's up next?
Number three is All for Love by Color Me Bad.
Okay. So I've been talking a bunch about how I was in a classic rock and, you know, I was like, definitely in the mode of a lot of this music was beneath me and stuff like that. And I never would have admitted it at the time, but this is definitely a guilty pleasure song for me. I actually really like this song.
Hmm.
I bet you never would have guessed that.
No, I never would have. I mean,
Color Me Bad.
I suppose it's the best one of their singles that I remember. I mean, out of the three I remember.
I actually didn't mind any of their three hits. I'm not going to go out and buy their albums, but this song was just a pure pop song. It was just cool, up-tempo, kind of new jack swing-ish, although not necessarily, but just cool, you know, snappy pop song. I liked it. And one of the two of the people credited as co-writers are, believe it or not, are Steve Cropper and Isaac Hayes, because they used a sample from a 60s Stax song in this, which is kind of obscure. But what cracked me up is when I was looking up Color Me Bad, or it didn't crack me up, I guess this is accurate, but the quote in one of their entries was, Color Me Bad were considered the leaders of a resurgence of post-doo-wop harmony group singing in the early 1990s. Color Me Bad invented the term hip-hop doo-wop to describe its sound. So, I mean, I'm not going to argue with that. That's basically what they were. So,
pretty much, yeah.
In a way, you know, I'm not saying Boys to Men followed their lead. They just happened to be out at the same time. So, anyway, I'll give this song some love. People make fun of Color Me Bad because their imagery was easy to make fun of because they all wore like extremely loud colored shirts and pants that definitely went out of style like 6 months after their run on the charts ended. So, I'll give it up for them.
Okay.
Number two for you, Matt, is I Love Your Smile by Shanice.
And let's see, Shanice, kind of like a couple of the other people I've covered on this chart, is also kind of hyped up as the next big thing. I think she was probably like 17 or 18 when the song came out. She was still in high school. And she was an alum of the TV show Kids Incorporated. And Martika of Toy Soldiers fame and Fergie from the Black Eyed Peas were also on Kids Incorporated at the time.
I did not know that.
Right. And kind of an average R&B track. It actually kind of reminds me of the McDonald's I Lovin' It jingle. Yeah. And Branford Marsalis played sax on the track, and it is 80s sax. And Shanice does a rap verse for some reason, which was...
Of course, you had to do a rap verse in a song back then.
Right, and this was kind of... I mean, this was when the R&B singers did their own rap. This was before they found out that they could actually pay real rappers to do verses on their songs. And unfortunately, that kind of led into the trend later on of rappers thinking they could sing, but... of its time.
Yeah,
I mean, it's
there was a wing of R&B that was like wholesome R&B, and this would definitely be in that definition.
Oh yeah, very wholesome. So, well, let's get into number one here.
Oh boy, I can't wait.
Don't Let the Sun Go Down on Me by George Michael and Elton John.
Yeah, this would not have been in my earbuds of the time, or whatever you want to call it, my Walkman. It's probably honestly better than the original song, but that's only a commentary on my part because I really don't care for... That's one Elton John song from the 70s I could do without. So take that bit of praise with a grain of salt. It actually was on an Elton John album. It was on Elton John's Duets album, which was a big thing in the 90s. Frank Sinatra did one, and among others. And this was easily the biggest hit off of that. It also included Don't Go Breaking My Heart, which he originally did with Kiki D in the 70s, only this time he did it with celebrity for no good reason, RuPaul. So, you know, geez, I mean, I don't know. But I don't, you know, I've never been a big fan of this song, either in the original form or this one. This one was recorded live. And I guess the video they shot for it was basically a live video.
It was, yeah.
But yep. It was also, there was parts of it that were, as a lot of quote unquote live videos were at the time, actually a lot of it was faked. And they did have Elton John come on stage with George Michael at a Chicago show, which is where they used some of the footage, but then a lot of the other parts of the live video were staged, I guess. So, you know, not a song that speaks to me very much. So not a number one that resonates, but, This is another one where, you know, George Michael did have some hits after this, but he was close to the end of his run too. And which would have not seemed possible at the time, because he had been on such a roll since the mid 80s, but we're definitely getting George Michael fatigue. I mean, I remember Dana Carvey making fun of him on Saturday Night Live and all that, but
our sister was really into them, like around the Faith era too.
Yeah, a lot of people were. Thank God. I remember when I lived in at a previous place in an apartment, some dude played God, I can't remember what George Michael song it was. Anyway, he played it for like 24 hours straight because presumably broken up with his girlfriend or something. But anyway, you know, it is what it is. It was pretty popular at the time. I don't know how much people listen to it now, but it was there at the top spot.
Yep.
So you get to pick for next week, Matt. Where are we headed?
Well, we are staying in the 90s, but we're doing something a little different. We're going to the alternative chart, and it's February 11th, 1995, alternative songs.
Nice. Am I going to hear any?
So where were you in 95?
I was in Ohio in 1995. I was taking a year.
Well, so was I.
I know. We were both in the same spot. I was taking a year off of school. So, but that would have been the period that would have been in my wheelhouse at the time. So.
This was like the absolute high watermark of alternative rock radio, I think.
Well, so. Well, our listeners will have to look forward to that. So,
yeah,
that's it this week for With a Bullet podcast. We might be changing the name of the podcast. We'll see. Matt and I have been discussing that. But anyway, Matt, have a good week and send us off.
All right. As they would say in 1992, Audi 5000.
Yeah, okay. All right. That's it. Thanks a lot for listening.
Yeah. Bye.